Welcome to the Not Old, Better Show. I'm Paul Vogelzang. In his early 50s, Dan Lyons lost his job reporting on the tech industry for Newsweek. And at the very same moment in time, the traditional media industry was imploding due to the internet, social media, blogging, and user-generated content.
My problem was not just that Newsweek was kind of struggling and laying people off and kind of going out of business, but that the entire industry I was in was collapsing and kind of falling apart.
So Dan went to work at tech startup HubSpot, where Dan was the designated old guy and was given the title of marketing fellow. But again, Dan is in his mid-50s at this point.
And you start thinking, well, what am I going to jump to? I have to reinvent myself and become something new. I have to start a whole new career. But you're doing it at the age of 50, which is tricky and not had some special challenges.
Today, I talk with author Dan Lyons about his memoir, Disrupted, My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble. Dan has also written for the HBO comedy series, Silicon Valley.
Welcome to the Not Old, Better podcast, a podcast dedicated to your future. The Not Old, Better podcast is all about revealing your future, offering clarity, health, happiness, and all things senior geek chic. And now your host, Paul Vogelzang.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to the Not Old, Better show. I'm Paul Vogelzang, your host. My guest today on the show is Dan Lyons. Dan, who's with me here on the line, you know, many of my listeners are going to know you as somebody who's reported on and satirized the tech industry. Dan has reported on the industry for Newsweek and Forbes. Dan wrote the satirical fake Steve Jobs blog. One of my favorite shows, Silicon Valley. Dan's been a member of the writing team for HBO for a couple of seasons. I think it's two and three, and I think three is just coming out now. Dan, unfortunately.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Yep, good. Dan was laid off. Dan, you were laid off from Newsweek shortly before it continued discontinued its print edition. And I think that was around April 2013 when you were 52. And next came some soul searching, maybe some panic that I certainly can relate to. And you took a job in the world that you'd long been writing about, and you became, and I love this title, you became a marketing fellow at a startup called HubSpot, which sells marketing software and, you know, helps companies attract through lead generation and blog posts and very much a kind of a customer-driven focus. I personally have some familiarity with HubSpot, having been at Oracle. I, of course, relate to your story a great deal, Dan, after having been laid off by Oracle at then age of 56. But it was very clear to me in reading the book that that you were kind of designated the old guy, and that you were maybe even twice the age of some of the people that you worked with there at HubSpot. You stayed for about 2 years, and now you've written a new book, a memoir called Disrupted, My Adventure in the Startup Bubble. And you describe the book as a story, and I think this is what really is very appealing to my listeners, and that is what it's like to reinvent yourself and start a new career in your 50s. And do that in an industry that is, by and large, hostile to older workers. Again, I related very much to the book. You know, the other thing that I noticed, Dan, was that you kind of wanted to skewer maybe some of this popular kind of mythology about startups and do that a little bit from the inside, you know, kind of while working there. I think also what was interesting to me, and again, I'll put links to a lot of this stuff, and we can talk about some of it, but almost out of a Hollywood script, the FBI investigated whether there'd been an attempt to prevent the book, the Disrupted book, from publication. There was some extortion, perhaps. Again, the FBI investigated. an equally interesting story we can kind of touch on. But again, I'll have lots of links. I just encourage all my listeners to read this book, go out, get it, buy it. It is really worth it. I think there's so much for us to talk about, Dan. One of the chapters which really struck me was this beached white male chapter, and I thought about that particularly as it relates to me. And I know many of my listeners who were 50 plus themselves, they really want to know what you did once you found yourself, you know, suddenly out of work as a 52-year-old journalist, and were you even right then at that moment your own kind of version of the beached white male?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, that article, there was a cover story in Newsweek called Beached White Males, and it ran in, I think, 2011 when I was working there, and I was the tech guy there, and I remember seeing that show up on that week's edition, and I read the story, and it was kind of a scary story about guys who were, you know, around 50 and mostly men, and around, you know, late 40s, 50-year-olds who had climbed up and up and up and hit a certain point, and then in the big recession of 2008 and 2009 and the collapse around there, they had been the hardest hit, disproportionately hit by that downturn. And I remember seeing the story and thinking, oh, that was interesting and a little bit scary. And then 2 years later, that was me, you know. And yeah, I remember thinking, oh my God, you know, this. My problem was not just that Newsweek was kind of struggling and laying people off and kind of going out of business, but that the entire industry I was in collapsing and kind of. And then you start thinking, well, what am I going to jump to? I have to reinvent myself and become something new. I have to start a whole new career, but you're doing it at the age of 50, which is tricky and not had some special challenges.
Yeah, and I think you probably did have at least a sense of some advantage that you might have, because as a tech reporter, you were reporting on some of the interesting technology that was being used. You were reporting maybe on some of the bigger companies and maybe their use of corporate journalism or blogging software or different platforms to use to communicate with customers even. And so that kind of led to this maybe this kind of natural but yet very convenient geographically opportunity at HubSpot.
Right. That was the one lifeline I could see, was this idea of corporate journalism, where companies, just as the media companies were all collapsing and laying off reporters like me in droves, companies were starting to hire us up, and they were looking to hire reporters to work in-house for them. So some companies are actually building newsrooms. They'll hire a dozen reporters, and they have them covering the industry that they're in. So you're not really writing press releases. You are really kind of doing journalism, but your paycheck comes from a different kind of company. And I thought, okay, that's a new thing that's kind of growing up in the ashes of this collapse of the media business. And I'll just jump into one of those places and get some experience, and then I'll try to become an expert in this new area of corporate or branded journalism, that some people call it. And that'll be a new career, but it won't be such a big wrenching change. It's not like learning something completely new. It's still kind of familiar to me. At least that's what I thought. So I went to work at a smallish company, 500 people, but in Cambridge, which is near where I live. I live outside Boston. So I didn't have to move to Silicon Valley. I could stay where I was and make a transition that way. So that's what I set out to do.
Yeah, and as I said previously, you stayed about 2 years. So it probably wasn't the big success that maybe you'd thought or hoped for. And in your book, you write, and I love this quote, HubSpot's leaders were not heroes, but rather a pack of sales and marketing charlatans who spun a good story about magical transformation technology and got rich by selling shares in a company that still has never turned a profit. So that was kind of in retrospect, but maybe it again, it seemed like from kind of my reading that even from the very first day there, you knew that something was amiss, that maybe it was a mistake. And so what was that like, that sense of kind of foreboding?
I got to the company and, from the first day I started having misgivings and I was thinking, oh, I can't just quit. I just started here. I have to put in a year or some period of time and give it a chance, right? And give myself a chance to adjust and adapt. But I think the main thing was a sense of there was nobody in charge. Like, this was a company where I showed up for my first day of work and the people I was working for and my boss and the guy underneath him, they weren't even there. And they kind of had forgotten that I was coming. Like, they didn't even, oh, God, today's your first day. Like, we didn't even know. And then another guy came to meet me, and he didn't really know what I was supposed to do. So he said, I'll show you around, and I can take you to the desk where I guess you'll be working maybe, and you can take along with some paperwork, but I don't know what you're supposed to do. And he was so new, he didn't know what he was supposed to do. And it was just this kind of place where people were coming and going all the time and not really knowing who's in charge or what are we all supposed to be doing. And that was a little, and I started getting a bad vibe. Like, I think they hired me to do one thing because the two founders liked me and interviewed me and said, oh, yeah, you'll come in and do this. But then they handed me off to someone else who said, oh, I don't know what he's doing. And just, so I was kind of lost while roaming around in this place. But it did give me time to look around and start seeing some things about how new companies operate and how this concept of work they have, which is different than the concept of work that maybe you and I had at the beginning of our careers. So it was an interesting place to watch and learn and observe. But as a job, no, it was started right off the bat to be a little bit weird.
Yeah, some of the things that seemed kind of weird were, you know, the candy wall, the shower pods, even some of the language, and then some of the other companies. I love some of these names. I really don't even remember some of these names, but Klinkle and Kaggle and Vungle and Gangaroo. And
Gangaroo, yeah.
Yeah. And there were some acronyms, too. What were some of those acronyms that were I thought that was really odd.
Oh, you know, they had a whole special language. So it was like GSD is one, like get shit done. Like, you're a real GSD player, you know. We're just a GSD kind of team. And they had 1 + 1 = 3, which doesn't really mean anything, but they would use it like all the time. Like, that idea isn't 1 + 1 = 3 enough. And I don't even know what that means. But there were lots of jargon. They used the word delightion, which meant we're in the business of delightion. We're not selling software. We're in the business of making magical moments happen in people's lives, you know. And when people got fired, they would call it graduation. So they'd say, well, so-and-so has graduated, and we wish him all the best with his superpowers as he goes off on his next big rock star adventure. And it was very crazy and Orwellian to me that there was this obviously kind of lack of control and discipline, and nobody knew what they were doing. But there was also this cheery thing about, like, everything's awesome, you just got fired, and that's awesome, we're so happy for you, you got fired, good luck, you know. And it's just a bizarre way of doing things. Yeah,
yeah. And some of my listeners are going to recognize the reference to Up With People. I thought that was really telling too.
Our generation will get that. Yeah, yeah. We understand Up With People. I think, unfortunately, people half our age won't remember what Up With People was. But that's what it was like, you know, we're up with people and everybody's great. I there was a woman who got fired after 3 months. She was only 22. It was her first job out of college. She got fired because they said she wasn't excited enough. It's like, really, that's a fire alarm? Like, you're not excited enough. You just don't seem excited enough. We're gonna have to let you go. And it wasn't like, we're going to give you a chance to get more excited. It was like, no, take your stuff. You're going right now. Like, not even 2 weeks. Like, today, you're done right now. You're in a meeting. Take your stuff and go. So it's just weird. I mean, I had never seen a place where they would do things like that to you.
Yeah, kind of almost this, the youth are in charge and, you know, maybe always not a great thing, but maybe not necessarily a bad thing. But it really produced this kind of sense that you had about amateur hour and the fact that your boss, the guy that hired you, wasn't even there on the first day that, you know, you were to arrive and begin working there. And then this same boss, you refer to him as Cranium, he spent a lot of his time, conducting surveys.
I don't know where he was. Like, I never had a meeting with him. He never, like, I kept thinking, well, he's not here today. It's Monday, but maybe he'll be in tomorrow or Wednesday. And he's going to, usually you get a new job and your boss says, well, come on in, let's talk about what you're going to be doing here and what I want from you and blah, blah, blah. But I never saw him again. Like, that was it. Like, I'd see him at the weekly meetings, but he was just, I don't know what he did. And then the guy under him would sort of tell me, just do whatever you want. And I was like, well, what do you mean? Just write whatever you want. Just do that. And I'm like, I don't know. I think it was just a weird thing where the big bosses hired me and they liked me, but then the people under them didn't know what to do with me. So they just kind of said, well, go sit over there in the corner, to stay out of the way.
There was some thought, I think, on your part that maybe you were brought in as kind of maybe this is my term, not yours, but kind of the show pony in anticipation of an IPO, and that was, going to lead to employment for just so long, and then post IPO, you might get reorged and do something else.
Yeah, that's in fact, that's what a friend of mine said. In fact, he used that exact term, that, sometimes companies or PR companies will do this. They'll hire a journalist that has kind of a name that people know, and they're like, they can bring you to meetings and trot you out, and you say, hey, blah, 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 and it's like, you don't have to do much. Just kind of like, it's just hiring you is enough, and they get a little buzz out of that, and their name gets in the paper a couple times, and that's enough, and then they go public and kind of quietly get rid of you, and they don't need you anymore. So I thought that, I didn't think that's why I was being hired, I think that might have been it. I don't know.
And as you were starting to catch on to some of this, do you think your coworkers, some of the folks that were kind of half your age, do you think they were catching on to you not really kind of buying in and drinking the Kool-Aid? And, I often think, when it's a generational kind of thing, we all kind of share responsibility for understanding, for kind of, do you think they knew?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they knew I didn't fit in right away, and I think they didn't want me around, and I think they were very, very eager to get rid of me, and at one point I sort of complained about the age bias, which I had never encountered before in my life. I didn't, and they sort of responded by saying that I was the problem, and even now that I've written this book and pointed out sort of age bias, mm-hmm. They've responded by creating a Twitter account called Old Man Lions, and they make tweets about me being an old guy and get off my lawn and stuff like that. It's just like, okay, you really don't get it. Like, they knew. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And yet they seemed so. On the one, there were just these contradictions, and I think this exists in a lot of companies, but particularly in the world of tech, where there's a great deal of sensitivity to maybe issues around gender or race, and in particular, you talk about kind of the Fearless Fridays and this this notion of feminism and being strong and how you kind of, thought that, you wanted to be supportive, you didn't want to seem like the curmudgeon there, but yet there was no sensitivity to this subject of kind of ageism. As a matter of fact, they kind of just winked and kind of went along their merry way.
Yeah, I wrote an article last week and about this, and it has had an incredible response, but I basically said, when it comes to age bias, tech companies don't even bother to lie. Like, they'll at least lie about wanting to do better with diversity in terms of race and gender. But they are basically adamant about saying that we really don't want to hire people over 40, and we think that's the right way to go. And it's overt. It's not subtle. It's actually overt bias, and hiring and firing decisions are made based on someone's age. And when I published this article, I've had so many emails from people writing to me telling me about their experience. And these are not old, what we would think of as old people. These are people who are 40, mm-hmm. which is not an elderly person. I had an email from a guy who's 32 in Silicon Valley saying he's worried because he feels old because he's no longer the guy who's right out of college, and he's competing for jobs against guys who are right out of college, and though he seems old. So it's an incredible story, an incredible weird upside down world that that exists here.
Yeah, for some of my reasons. So you're referring to the LinkedIn article that you wrote that.
Yeah, I'll post it.
I'll make sure that that link is available. I thought that was really interesting. Yeah, and I thought, you know, with respect to, you know, there were lots of talk there about you know, creating a lovable company and PowerPoint decks and and yet, you know, there's this potential for, or certainly this issue that came up that, you know, after your manuscript was done, that your laptop might have been hacked and that the FBI investigated and that extortion was involved. And so it just, again, there are just these contradictions in kind of this behavior. And again, it just comes back to this kind of notion of amateur hour at times.
Well, yeah, and I left thinking they were just kind of doofuses and kind of it was just out of control and this sort of, I almost felt bad because I was like, well, they don't know what they're doing and they're just kind of hacking away at this company. And but then, yeah, several months after I left, or half a year after I left, I had posted a blog on it saying, you know, I'm contracted to write a book about what it's like to be 50 and try to reinvent yourself and start a new career in a kooky tech company. It's kind of a funny memoir. And I guess they got all worried about what might be in the book. And, yeah, they did something involving hacking. And according to the FBI documents that I've seen, they tried to extort people who were maybe at the publishing company to keep them from publishing the book. There's a couple of funny things. One is this very scary kind of stuff that was no longer funny to me. It was really, like, a little bit terrifying. Like, I didn't realize that was the kind of people these are. And secondly, they still won't tell me what they did. So they still talk this sort of thing about, we're lovable and we have this remarkable culture and we're so hippy-dippy happy. And they talk about being radically transparent. But they seriously just still won't tell me, just to even put my mind at ease, like, okay, here's what these guys did. We fired them. They're all gone now. But what they did was X, Y, and Z, and everything's fine. Just change your passwords and you'll be okay. I still don't know what they stole from me or what they did. So that's it's kind of not funny because this is a company also that has, they have records, you know, customer records on 18,000 customers and all the customers of those companies. So tens of thousands of people, they have information on addresses and names and phone numbers and email and maybe social security numbers. They have information like this, and I don't think the people running this company are really trustworthy. So that actually became something that I set out to write, just a funny book about, you know, reinvention, and it turned into something kind of weirder and darker that I hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, you even touch on this idea that, you know, it's almost a Jonestown. It's almost a brainwashing that goes on, that the yeah, candy walls, that the, you know, the dogs in the hallways, the Nerf gun battles, all of that stuff to make work, quote unquote, fun, is really also hiding, you know, something that may be a little bit malevolent, and that this quote unquote mission that they claim to be on really isn't as genuine as, you know, they often claim, and that's not necessarily, you know, just you know, HubSpot's issue, that's going on in a lot of kind of startups right now.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to write about it, because I thought this has become this new thing of working with, everybody has to have these kooky headquarters and a slide and a candy wall and everything's really fun and awesome. And then I started thinking, why is that? Why are they doing that? What is the real ulterior motive behind that? And I came to think that it's actually that a whole generation of young people are actually kind of being conned a little bit. They're being lured into these environments where the work they're doing really isn't that meaningful or rewarding or fulfilling. But if you give them enough bread and circus and enough rhetoric about how important they are, maybe it starts to feel that way. So, yeah, that struck me as something worth writing about.
Yeah, it seemed like, too, the other thing that struck you throughout the book was this idea that you'd been really brought in as this respected journalist with wonderful experience and a lot of talent, yet you were, you know, writing lead gen blog post copy, and that that's about as far as it went. And so here you are with this stature and credential, and that wasn't really even something that you know, was respected by the coworkers or maybe the company. Maybe it was initially by the two founders who brought you in, but it became more and more apparent that just wasn't gonna, you know, there wasn't a meeting of the minds on some of this stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's definitely a lack of communication there between the way the company communicates with employees. It's definitely something to be desired.
Do you ever think, this is my own maybe wacky theory, but I really think that this term content is kind of demeaning to almost the subject of literature or art or songwriting. You know, it's not one and the same. And so a lot of this generation views content in a particular way. However, you know, it's not the same. It writing in the way that you do is very different than writing 8 key points to understanding HTML.
Yeah, right. And that's what I found myself writing, was sort of like low end kind of blog posts and, you know, whatever. There's a market for that, and there's a business to be built on that kind of stuff. It's just kind of not what I wanted to do. But it's content marketing, and there's, you know, the companies really are, you know, building businesses around that stuff.
Sure. And these issues aren't immune to, you know, other companies, certainly, you know, Oracle and Facebook and Google. They're all, you know, trying to at least, you know, kind of talk through it. I just don't think that they are accepting of some of the differences. And, you know, I know from just my personal experience, you know, I have a sister who's a physician in Seattle, and she's just over 50, and she's just kind of hitting her stride at her age. And yet, you know, those of us who maybe are just over 50, or maybe in the case of this one individual who reached out to you at 32, you know, that kind of experience and stature just isn't of interest, and it certainly isn't rewarded. And as a matter of fact, it's even terminated. And I think that's a big difference for our society.
I totally agree. And it's funny you mention your sister, because I have a sister-in-law who is, my wife's sister, is a surgeon, and she's 40, and she's really just beginning her career at 40. And she's just finished all of her training and fellowships. And she's just setting off on the next 20, 25 years of her career. And no one would suggest to her that, well, you know, you can't cut it anymore. Quite the opposite. You're just now, you've learned enough that we'll trust you to do this. So, yeah, I think it's bunk, this idea that people at 50 just can't stop or can't do things. I think in a lot of other fields, that you're the height of your career at that age. And just tech is this weird world where they've decided that this is okay, that this is just all right to just, you know, can people at 40 or 50. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, it just doesn't. I mean, oftentimes as you, especially in medicine, you begin working with the interns. You begin kind of a formal training process that is very much passing information and experience along, which is valued.
Right, institutional knowledge, which I think is if companies become just transactional about their hiring, like, bring you in and churn, you know, burn you out, churn you out after 2 years, and there's no institutional knowledge or wisdom. But then I think there's also, it reflects a certain new kind of company that isn't maybe necessarily expecting to be in business forever or for decades, and they're very short-term focused, and they're very much about, you know, telling a story, going public, and cashing out. And that's a new kind of business model that has become prevalent in tech, especially when new startups in that case, they're not creating sustainable jobs. They're not creating careers that any of us want to have. They're just sort of fly by night places that set up shop for a few years and bring in a lot of people and whip them up and give them beer and then burn them out and throw them out. It's a brutal sort of model, really.
It really is.
Yeah.
And so what advice would you give to kind of our generation that, you know, we're, many of us are very, very capable at, and with it, and you want to even use our skills, you know, and we kind of need to outsmart some of this a little bit. So what do we do?
I know the best thing I think I've heard, and I don't know, I'm struggling with this myself, but one thing is I've heard from people who said, I just decided to go out on my own. I started my own company or I bought a small business and I kept sticking my head into the buzzsaw trying to get a job at a tech company or a new job at this, you know, some kind of company or at a startup and no one would hire me. So I just sort of struck it out on my own. And maybe that's the way. Maybe it's entrepreneurship. And I think maybe that is a world where your skills that you've had actually are valuable and you reap the reward for the work you put in because it's your own little business. And that's something I'm thinking about now.
That's good. That's good. Mm-hmm. Well, selfishly, what could you tell us about Silicon Valley?
I'm not working on the show anymore. I just did two seasons. I did helped out on season two and on season three, and it was just a helper. But I would tell you that it was really, really fun, and the people who run that show are incredibly funny and smart, and I really do get the world of tech more than you would think. They really, really do know that world. And, it was a really phenomenal experience and something new for me to do at my age. But I loved the opportunity to do it. But I don't know what else I could tell you about the show. I don't really know the actors or anything. I was there in a writing room with a bunch of people writing scripts and coming up with story ideas. So I didn't stay through production while we were shooting the show.
Yeah, well, it's a great show, and I just I think it's a really interesting kind of intersection that you've had these experiences and they're fascinating to me along with the book. I really enjoyed reading Disrupted. I've got my wife reading. I've got two boys, a 23-year-old, and he's kind of setting out on his course. I want him to pay attention to it. I think it's just a book for everybody to read and understand and know that this is going on. There's some really funny parts to it. Dan, I think there's some really kind of very important parts for us to think about as kind of a society and what we're doing with our economy and kind of going forward. But it has been a pleasure to talk with you. I of course, very excited and wanted to have this conversation. So I appreciate your time. Anything else you want to share with us this day?
No, but thank you so much for having me. And I'm glad you enjoyed the book and got a kick out of it. Thanks so much. Yeah,
it was really great. So Dan Lyons, thank you for your time today. And certainly we'll follow up. And we will also follow you on all the various social pages and sites, and I'll put links to all of that.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Navigating you to a future of clarity, health, happiness, and senior geek chic. Choosy seniors choose better. The Not Old, Better podcast. Not old, better. You can also find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and SoundCloud. Check out the website, notoldbetter.com, for easy-to-find links to keep up with us on social media. If you like our show, please remember to rate us on iTunes and SoundCloud. The Not Old, Better podcast, sponsored by Senestet, is produced every month for your enjoyment and development. Show notes and links are found at notoldbetter.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and be sure to add us to your favorite RSS feed at iTunes or SoundCloud.